Thank you for listening to this Resonating Reconciliation documentary. It has been made possible by Truth and Reconciliation, National Community Radio Association, and the Red Jam Slam Society. We recognize that you may be triggered by some of the content, and we apologize for any profanity. A crisis line is available to provide immediate emotional assistance and can be reached 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 1-866-925-4419. Indian Residential Schools Resolution Health Support Program contact information by province and territory in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, and Labrador, and Prince Edward Island can be reached at toll-free 1-866-414-8111 and a teletypewriter at 1-800-267-1245, Health Canada. In Quebec, the telephone number toll-free is 1-877-583-2965 or by teletypewriter 1-800-267-1245. The crisis line in Ontario is telephone number, which is a toll-free number, 1-888-301-6426. By teletypewriter 1-800-263-1245. In Manitoba, please call telephone number 1-866-818-3505 or via teletypewriter 1-800-267-1245. In Saskatchewan, please call telephone number 1-866-250-1529 or via teletypewriter 1-800-267-1245. In Alberta, please call toll-free 1-888-495-6588 or teletypewriter 1-800-267-1245. In British Columbia, in Vancouver, please call toll-free 1-877-477-0775 or via teletypewriter 1-800-267-1245. In the Yukon Northwest Territories and Nunavut, please call telephone number 1-800-464-8106 or teletypewriter 1-800-267-1245. Thank you for listening to Resonating Reconciliation.
I still remember the first time I heard about Indian residential schools. I was 16, sitting in a grade 12 history course watching a documentary titled Unrepentant, Canada's Hidden Genocide. It was strange. I was the only Native girl in the class, and yet I knew little about the horrors Aboriginal people were subject to under the hand of the Canadian government and multiple churches. I had known that we had had our land and our freedom taken from us at various points across history, but as a girl who grew up off reserve, I was, for all intents and purposes, a white kid with a status card. But as I watched as the survivors told their stories to an interviewer, something clicked. As a Mi'kmaq woman, I didn't want to be indifferent to these issues anymore. They involved me just as much as the people on reserve. It was my history, too. I was a part of a group of people that had faced unimaginable horror, a group that dealt with the same injustices they'd confronted for centuries, year after year.
One particular individual, I went home in the summer and learned how to speak his own language, and his dad had taught him how to carve. Then we went back to school. He continued doing this, speaking his own language and carving. And the teacher caught him and took his knife away and broke his carving up. And he took a pencil and he drove it right through his hand. And you still see the scar where he drove the pencil right through his hand.
In the years following my introduction to the residential school system, I took in everything I could. I read the survivor stories, I watched clips of the official apology issued, and with each bit of information I processed, I grew both angrier with those that condoned these things, and more impressed with the way the Aboriginal survivors and the following generations were able to move forward, despite the repercussions of a terrible attempt by their own country to exterminate them completely. These are still felt, even now.
The mental health implications of IRS, which are huge, obviously because you have the survivors, and then you have their families. All these people have had their parenting skills stolen from them. They have had their language and their culture stolen from them. They have been mentally, physically, and sexually abused. Some, not all of them, some of them. So they are passing down those traits to their family members. Some of them only know how to deal with these through alcohol or drug abuse, and then they're not proper parents. So it's the residential school is also directly impacted among people aren't able to hold a job because of the mental abuse. It's also Mi'kmaq family, so children are being taken from their homes, and it all links back to the residential school system.
I needed to teach others about what the Indian residential schools had done to Canada's Aboriginal people, so that they wouldn't become indifferent like I had been. You see, I'm from Atlantic Canada, a place that had been home to only one residential school, which was located in Chibinacadie, Nova Scotia. Though the toll this institution took on our First Nations communities was great, the level of understanding among the people here is not where it should be. Chibinacadie was alone, and because of this it has been forgotten by many. Some even refuse to acknowledge its existence.
There's this mythology about what Canada is, and people tend to think that Canada would never do this to its citizens, would never do this. Their government would never do this. We have a just government. We're the peacekeepers of the world. We're the best country in the world to live in. So they cannot fathom in their minds that this stuff happened. They have to put it away and say, oh, it happened a long time ago. Why don't you guys just forget about that? That was forever ago. Well, the effects are happening still today. The last residential school closed in 1996. That wasn't that long ago.
But the wounds dug at Chibinacadie were all too real.
There was one residential school, which was the Chibinacadie Residential School, and it was open from 1929 to 1967. During that time, the sisters at the Mount St. Vincent's, the Sisters of Charity, were the teachers, and the oblates were the priests. The reason why they were running this school in this area, it was to, in their words, it was to educate. But if you look at the greater context of residential schools, the whole mission was to Christianize and to civilize, and I say that in air quotes, our people. What the main mission was to come in and have First Nations people learn how to run a house and serve people in the houses and become farmhand. They didn't really consider us real people. What they considered us to be was less than. So it didn't matter if we had the trappings of wealth and, you know, wealth as we seen it, or even we were savvy traders and had acquired stuff. They wanted the resources of this land. They wanted us in the lower rungs of society. So how did they do that? They take the children from the family so they can control how the communities progress. Out west, there was First Nations that were still in open rebellion of the Canadian government. They said they will not rebel against us if we have their children. We remove the child from this environment. We can mold these children to be who we want them to be. Not what their community wants them to be, not what their parents want them to be, what we as the government and the church want them to be, and how we see them fitting in our society, where we are the dominant society and they're at the lower rungs. The kids went into the residential school, they took them in, they deloused them, they cut their hair, they removed their clothing, they gave them uniforms. They gave them numbers. There would be numbers in their clothes, so everything would be number 1 or number 27. So they wouldn't call them by their names. They wouldn't say, Amanda, come here. They would say, number 27, you left your socks on the floor. They were denied the basic rights any child should have. Not only were they denied the love and the care of their parents and the acceptance and love of their community, they were denied basic human rights, like to a nationality, to a name, to be treated better than an animal. Because sometimes people treated animals better than how residential school survivors were treated.
After learning what I could about what the survivors went through, I began to question how a child could grow up and come to terms with what had happened to them. What does it mean to heal, really? I knew of the problems that these institutions had caused, but what I really wanted to know was how the survivors were able to overcome the obstacles that they faced. I had heard the awful stories. It was time to find that silver lining. This documentary follows my investigation to discover how the First Nations residential school survivors in Atlantic Canada are coping with and healing from their experiences in the schools. I spent the greater part of my summer traveling around the Maritimes, interviewing those who worked closely with First Nations health and well-being. From them, I learned a great deal, and I hope that by passing their knowledge on, I can promote understanding of the legacy of the Indian residential schools and inspire others with stories of strength from remarkable people. This is an account of unfathomable pain, but even more so than that, it is a story of recovery and restoration.
I've seen one survivor just grumble at a hearing when another survivor was talking about getting sodomized by a priest.
One gentleman who explained that when he joined the military in the 60s, they shaved his head and his head was permanently dented in all these different places, because the nuns had used a metal ruler, the edge of it, to hit him every time he did something they didn't like.
She can't turn her neck like this, like moving her head back and forth with keeping her shoulders straight because of an injury she sustained in residential school. So now she has to move her entire body because of the fact that they didn't get her proper medical attention.
I remember being at the Native Mental Health Association meeting about 3 years ago, and I was in a sharing circle with this elder, and she had said that she lost her language, and the reason was when she was five, she was kidnapped by the Big Bird, that's what she called it, a helicopter. Came down, took her from her community, and every time she spoke her own language, they shoved a safety pin through her tongue. So she quit speaking altogether. So she said she didn't speak for 5 or 6 years because of the fear. And these are traumatic experiences. You're listening to it. I remember driving home and there was this huge lump in my throat. And I was like, I'm not going to cry. I ended up crying all the way from Sydney to Halifax, basically, because it was just devastating.
It has been said that it takes 7 generations to heal. We're only just beginning to hear the stories of the descendants of residential school survivors. The newer generations are feeling the effects of the residential schools too. Intergenerational survivors understand all too well how the experiences of their parents and grandparents can cause suffering in those who came after them.
My stepfather, he physically, mentally, and sexually abused me. So I went into counseling myself at an early age. I also had my mother, who was a big strength in my life. She was my best friend, and we did everything together. I could come to her for anything. She didn't realize that some of the abuse that he was doing to me, because I kind of kept it to myself. A picture or something could bring you right back to where you were. So it's something that you have to work on a daily basis. You have to be working on your healing every day. In the beginning, you're not understanding, okay, so you smell a certain smell, and it's like it takes you right back, okay, and then you start going into, like, anxiety, and you don't even know, you know, what this anxiety, what you're feeling. You don't even know it's anxiety. You're like, you just know that you're shaking, and you can't breathe, and so to learn all that stuff, and then go from there to learn how to heal.
I've seen firsthand, like, my family, they, like, everyone uses substance, so seeing all that too, and that had a big impact on, I guess, my family.
It isn't only the direct lineage of residential school survivors that have faced trials in the years after these institutions shut down. The First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people all over the country are facing serious hardship. Social issues, addictions, and other health problems plague them almost daily, and most of these crises can be traced back to Indian residential schools.
you live what you learn. And they didn't learn how to properly bond with their children because nobody properly bonded with them. And that was in varying degrees, some depending on how long they were at the residential school, what their experiences were, you know. So they, how could we expect them to be wonderful, fantastic parents when they didn't have the skills?
What you really learn really quickly is that health is linked to IRS. They're not separable. Mental health issues can manifest in like sore stomach, indigestion, yeah, right? Ulcers. These are all connected to mental health, right? So if you're not taking proper care of yourself, so if you're sitting on social and you're eating Kraft dinner every day and you're not exercising and you're 300 pounds and you get arthritis in your joints, and the reason why you can't leave your home and the reason why you don't know how to eat properly is because you're in a residential school, it's all linked.
Like, I've been working with our people for 40 years. Those same issues are still here today. Economic development, social housing, employment, education. They're all there. They're coming gradually, but not fast enough. Not fast enough for the population the way we're growing. So those issues still have to be addressed.
How they parented. Because when they were like shipped off so young and then they came back, I'm not saying they had a disconnect, but they didn't know how to parent right, I guess. Some of them.
They weren't loved.
Yeah, so, like, they didn't know how to, be a parent and nurture them and all that stuff. And a lot of it was, like, substance
and
abuse.
Language. Yeah, I was going to say the mouthy language is pretty...
Like, my gram, she's a speaker, but she chooses not to speak. I'm a mouth seat, so we don't have many speakers in a lot of the communities, and the speakers are the elders. So, and a lot of them did... like go to residential schools and they choose not to pass down their language ceremony as much in my community, as much as there should be. So that's probably one of the big things. And how some youths, like, they're like, I'm proud to be Native. I'm like, well, what does it mean to you? So it's like they don't know. They're like, I was like, what makes you so proud? It's not that I'm trying to, like, I don't know, make them feel bad, I guess, or trying to call them out. I just want them to, like, to ask them, like, do they really know who they are? And
there's a lot of loss of pride and loss of identity. Like, they don't know what it means to be Aboriginal. And I know with a lot of the Idle No More stuff, like, people are trying to get more active and trying to be more out there and trying to fight for their rights and stuff, but I still don't think they understand.
While the legacy of Indian residential schools takes its toll, Canadian and First Nations organizations fight back as they produce many avenues for healing for our survivors and their communities.
Well, I was the senior health policy analyst with the Atlantic Policy Congress, so I worked with all communities in Atlantic Canada. So I know one of the most brilliant things that we did when I was at APC was it was last summer, the youth, the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Atlantic Youth Council, every 2 years they have a conference. And this year they wanted to bring IRS survivors and Mi'kmaq youth and Maliseet youth together.
At the youth conference here in Fredericton at UNB, and it was bridging the gap between the survivors and the youth. So, like, kind of trying to deal with the intergenerational trauma that happened because of the residential schools. And what our vision was to not necessarily try to have the survivors tell their stories and try to live all that trauma that they've gone through, but to have the youth and the survivors at the same place working together, doing workshops together, like overcoming obstacles and stuff like that, to be able to work together. And just because we never, like me, myself, have never actually listened to a survivor talk about their experiences. That was my first time, and it was really... really eye-opening.
On behalf of the chiefs of the Atlantic, myself and Chief Debbie Robinson was chosen as women chiefs to sit on this committee for the residential school. What our purpose was there was to be there for support and to understand more about the situation and what happened. Some of the stories, a lot of people doesn't want to talk about it and others do. I mean, it's a choice if they want to or if they don't. It's a very hard decision for anybody to do, to talk
Unity
about.
Unity-wise, we have held various workshops and sessions on grieving and how to get past the grieving and learning how to heal with traditional ways, with smudging, the sweats, that type of thing.
I am working with the survivors issue, and it's the fourth one. It's with the Mi'kmaq Maliseet Healing Networking Center. The funding actually gets cut in December. But this is the fourth survivors gathering. So what they do is they have survivors from all New Brunswick and the Stukish and some from PEI come to King's Clear, and then we all just, all weekend, just fun stuff. So we don't talk about any trauma. It's not there for them to share their stories, but to hang out. Like, they do a lot of cultural stuff. We do, like, language. Well, we have workshops. Like, every year they're different. We have, like, comedians and stuff, like, just to make them laugh. Last year they made a quilt together. They make, like, they always make stuff every year. Like, one year they made rattles, and the year before that they made drums, and they made ash baskets. So this year I think they're making medicine bags. It's kind of like, that's kind of their healing, just getting them away and having them, like, something for them to look forward to.
Albert Marshall talks about two-eyed seeing, and it's the ability to see the world from our perspective and the non-First Nations perspective, and you have to kind of amalgamate them together to understand. So some First Nations people, if they want to heal, need to go to a counselor. Some First Nations people, they need to heal, they need to have a sweat. They need to smudge. They need to be able to do this when they need to do this. Some people need a combination. And some First Nations people say, I'm not cultural. I don't want to smudge. I don't want to have a sweat. I want a prescription, and I want to talk this out. You know, everybody's different, and you can't just prescribe traditional medicine to everybody. Everybody experiences things differently. Everybody copes with things differently. So you have to work with those people.
Well, there are some really good services. One of the things that has been successful, but unfortunately it's facing funding cuts, is the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. The Aboriginal Healing Foundation needs to continue. The work and the progress they've made to date needs to continue. Health Canada also has a Resolution Health Support program with Resolution Health Support workers that are, they're like the mental health paramedics, and they kind of triage situations, refer them over to counseling, help deal with the situations that are happening. They do more of an emotional and mental support. Then we have cultural support workers, and the cultural support workers help with people that don't want to talk so much but want to have a smudge, want to do a ceremony, want to have like a releasing ceremony, or because sometimes when you have trauma you build it all up on your shoulders, and they just take an eagle fan and they wipe you down.
But I think there's more that needs to be done, like around self-esteem issues, just building up who they are as a person, and then eventually talking about that stuff. So that's what I try to do the best I can. So I bring up a little bit like who they are as Maliseets or Mi'kmaq, but mostly it's just like trying to bring more self-esteem to them. By having more self-esteem, they're more prone to learn more about themselves and stuff, and actually have a sense of pride and actually know why they're proud.
We still have a lengthy path to tread. That is evident. But it only takes a small glance into the progress that we're making, no matter how large or small those achievements may seem, to find a glimmer of hope in a world of hurt.
She said, I healed myself as the years went by. I healed myself. But I did learn a lot, but I saw a lot of abuse as well. So she said, I don't need any healing. Like I say, she's healed herself, but as a chief, she needed a roof, and I knew she wouldn't probably be around when the compensation came out, the thousands of dollars that they were entitled to. So anyways, we as a band fixed her house. We fixed it all up, and she was so proud of that.
You know, I've attended, as the health director, I've attended many conferences and workshops, and the IRS program, you know, there are survivors out there that will tell their story at some of these conferences. Telling their story is helping healing. Allowing them just to talk and just, you know, just you listening can help heal. I truly believe that. Just allowing them to tell their story.
At the national event, I will tell you, one of the best things, how I knew the national event was successful, was there were survivors I had seen that were angry in the past and looked tired. They looked 30 years younger. They looked young. They looked like they had a weight taken off their shoulders. One residential school survivor told me, she said she was so happy with the national event, she felt respected. She had a place to stay, and it was a respectable hotel. She was able to tell her story, and she was believed. She said, we were fed really well at this national event, because she said before we were trying to tell people what happened to us, we were hungry. We were like six to a hotel room trying to scrounge up money to get to the meeting. Then she said she could smell the steak sometime off people's breath as they were talking to her, and she was super hungry. And so she said, before we used to bang on everybody's door trying to be heard, with the national event, we actually felt like we were heard. And we felt validated. And you could see that in how they were at the event, how they were after the event.
After having everything taken from us, and after having to deal with residential schools, and then having to deal with generations that have been hurt because of the things that have been done to our ancestors, what's your hope for the future?
I want to see, I'd like to see community members come together and actually be a community. Sometimes when people don't understand what a community member is going through, and that community member can isolate themselves and, I don't know, how do I say it? There are opinions put on different community members. I would love to see just, because I think that a healthy community, healthy people make a healthy community. Mm. That's what I'd like to see.
Youth have taken this. I know in Atlantic, especially through Mace, the youth have taken this as their mantle. Like, we will not let what happened to you define us. It's a positive thing, right?
Yeah.
We will not let what happened to you define us as a people. We are going to take it back. We are going to take our First Nations culture, our First Nations identity. We're going to take it back for you because this was done to you. You had no choice in this, right? We're going to take it back for you. And that is really
inspiring. I hope that people find their identity and find out who they are, really, and just get that self-esteem and are able to use their voices in a positive way as opposed to using it in a destructive way, to be able to be educated about things that are happening and to be able to contribute to, like,
pretty good at persevering, I guess, considering all the history that happened to us as First Nations people, not just First Nations but Aboriginal in general. I don't know, we still seem like a lot of us are, we're still trying to succeed. I think that there's a bright future for, like, Aboriginal people in general, just because, like, a lot of us, we don't let it, like, the history, like, define us. Like, we know it's there and we have, like, a general awareness, but we can't let it hold us down.
I do think more education has to be done within the students.
Yep.
And in the schools, and that is part of our history, and that should be in there. All nationalities should know about it, because they all know about the Holocaust, so they all should know about the Native residential schools. I think you have to put something up to say this will never ever happen again to the children. The children should never ever be taken away from the parents.
These are the types of things that the Canadian government really has to consider. You know? And if they're really serious about reconciliation, the survivors have said it, they have to put their money where their mouth is. They have to provide these things. You know, if they're... It took so many generations to get like this. It's going to take so many generations to get out of it. It's not a five-year fix. So we have to understand it. We have to accept what happened. And we have to say, you know, how can we fix this together as a nation?
There is hope. It shines on the horizon with every attempt we make to heal. We will reach it. We will achieve what we have been wishing for. The residential schools caused a massive amount of pain and horror, and these wounds are nowhere near being healed completely. There is a lot of work to be done, but if we as Canadians, both white and Aboriginal alike, band together to promote understanding, to fix the problems caused in generations past, sooner rather than later, we may see a people broken by genocide and discrimination rise stronger than ever before and flourish in a way that they have wished to see for centuries. Local 107.3 FM would like to thank the following people and organizations for their contributions to this documentary. Former Chief of Glooskap First Nation Shirley Clark, Amanda Peters, Charlotte Warrington, Vanessa Nevin, Miranda Mitchell, Sydney Paul, and the Atlantic Policy Congress of First Nations Chiefs.